I have a memory, or it's, I seem to have a memory that this is where we were.
That's the last one we were back.
So it's not my imagination? Okay, good. But actually, I've covered slide five already. Let's just quickly review what we've said. There are three categories of primary subatomic particles. And by primary, I mean the things that make up an atom. Secondary subatomic particles would be the things that are even smaller that make up the primary subatomic particles. But those three primary subatomic particle types are protons, neutrons, and electrons, recall. Protons and neutrons are found only in a nucleus. They are almost identically massive compared to each other. They are both much bigger than an electron. A proton and an electron are both charged, whereas a neutron is not. Any atomic nucleus contains one or more protons. If you don't have at least one proton, you don't have an atomic nucleus. Every atomic nucleus contains zero or more neutrons. And since there is one or more proton there, the atomic nucleus is charged positively, either positive 1, positive 2, or some positive integer, because each proton carries a positive 1 charge. Electrons, though they are much smaller, still carry an equally sized charge as a proton, but in the opposite direction. Electrons are negatively charged. They're never found in the nucleus. They're found only outside of the nucleus somewhere, in the space outside of the nucleus. And that's what we'll talk about now, starting with slide 6. I'm going to talk about spaces. Spaces are not structures. They're not made out of anything. They're just spaces that can be filled, can be occupied. And in slide 6, we see an atomic nucleus. No detail is shown here because the point of the slide is not the nucleus, it's the space around it. But there's some number of protons and maybe neutrons in there. The overall space outside of the nucleus can be subdivided into smaller spaces, which are themselves just spaces. So we're talking about spaces within a space. And those spaces within the space can be divided into smaller subspaces. It's still just spaces, not material. But by analogy, it's kind of like a house, although you have to imagine the house as not being made out of anything. It still has boundaries. They're just not real. I mean, they're not material. You know, so the entire house is a space. Within that, you have rooms that are subspaces. Within rooms, you could have closets that are subspaces of the subspaces. That's what we need to talk about. There are three levels of subspaces in this space around the nucleus of an atom. And the largest of them are featured in slide 6. Those largest subspaces are called either energy levels or electron shells, or for short, just shells. Okay, you can use those interchangeably, energy level and shell. We can see that the shells exist at various distances from the nucleus itself. And we number shells with integers, starting with shell 1, which is the closest one to the nucleus. Remember, it's not an object, it's just a space. But shell 1 is the closest one, and you might find electrons there. That's the whole idea of these spaces, is that they could be occupied by electrons. An electron, of course, is negative, as we've already talked about, and is therefore attracted to the oppositely charged nucleus because of its protons. Opposite electrostatic charges attract each other. And so electrons would like to be in the lowest energy level they can be at. It's their most stable situation, if they can. But that's the point. These subspaces that I'm talking about have limits to how much they can hold as far as electrons are concerned. Okay? So the energy level is 1, 2, 3, and so on. That's their names, just the integer, the positive integers. Electrons, another important part of this slide, is that any given electron is always within one shell or another, never between them. And that's what's trying to be explained by the arrows. So it's possible for an electron to go up an energy level from where it was, and it's possible to go back down. But it's just like this ball on the stairs analogy. You know, if you actually go through with this experiment and roll the ball downstairs, the ball could land on any of the steps or go all the way down, but it's never going to land halfway between steps, right? So just like electrons are never going to be halfway between an energy level. They're in one energy level or another. All right, so those are the largest spaces, shells or energy levels. Now if we go to 7, we can talk about subspaces within the shells. And each shell is made up of some number of subspaces called subshells. The name makes sense, right? Subshells are subspaces within a shell. Each subshell is then further subdivided into subspaces itself. And those subspaces are called orbitals, or electron orbitals technically, but usually we just say orbitals. Okay, so orbitals are the smallest of these three spaces I'm talking about. They would be like closets. Some number of orbitals makes up a larger space called a subshell. Those would be like a room. And some number of subshells makes up a space called a shell. That would be like the entire house. Okay? Now, all of these are just spaces, as I said. Here we can see a cartoon version of some of these orbitals that I'm talking about. There are different kinds of orbitals, different categories that we give letters to, and these different categories of orbitals have different geometric shapes. The space itself has a shape, but you could find an electron in there, maybe, in that shape of space. And every shell, every level, 1, 2, 3 and up. Well, let me start over. This might be easier to say this way. The categories that we kick, there's more than two categories, but you see two categories, two shapes of orbitals here. Spherical shaped ones, and you see two of those, the smaller one and the larger sphere. Those are examples of what are called S orbitals. But you also see three different P orbitals here. Each P orbital is shaped kind of like a dumbbell or an infinity symbol, but in three dimensions. And so this is one P orbital, this is another one, and this is a third. Obviously, they're drastically differently shaped compared to the S orbitals. So, however many of one type of orbital there are in one shell, those are lumped together to make up what is called a subshell. Said the other way around, a subshell includes all of the orbitals of the same category in that level. And the subshells are named for the kinds of orbitals that make them up. For instance, there's an S subshell, and there can be a P subshell that includes all the P orbitals in that level, and so on. There are D orbitals and F orbitals that you might study in a chemistry class, but in this course, all we really are paying attention to are the S orbitals and P orbitals. Okay, now let me say what I was starting to say earlier. Every level, one included, 1, 2, 3, all of the levels, each level contains an S subshell, because every level contains an S orbital. Okay? Every level contains exactly one S orbital, though. So the first level, its S subshell consists of just one S orbital. And so technically the S orbital in the first level and the S subshell are the same thing. The S subshell is a set that includes only one element, namely the S orbital itself. But in level 2, there's also an S subshell. It's a different S orbital that's in the second level. That would be the bigger sphere here. Still, though, there's only one of them, one S orbital in that level as well. So every level contains an S subshell that itself contains exactly one S orbital. Everyone following me? And we name orbitals, by the way, or we distinguish them from others of the same type by preceding the S or the P with a numeral that indicates the level they're in. This smaller of the two spherical or S orbitals is called the 1S orbital. And correspondingly, it makes up the 1S subshell. Any subshell includes all of the orbitals of the same type, but for S's, there's only one of them. All right? The second one, the bigger sphere, is the 2S orbital because it's in level 2. There's still only one of them, though, for that level. And there's a 3S that's not shown here, and so on. Level 1 includes only an S subshell. It doesn't have any other type of orbitals. So, level 1, the level 1 S subshell, and the 1S orbital really all refer to the same thing. Okay? It's three different names for the same space, really. Is that clear? Okay, starting with level 2, there is also an S subshell called the 2S subshell. It includes only a single S called the 2S orbital, but it also includes a P subshell because it has three different P orbitals in addition to that S. Since the P orbitals are a different kind of orbital, they are lumped together in their own subshell, the P subshell. So there is no P subshell in level 1, but there is in level 2 and higher. Okay? And then, unlike the S subshell that consists of only one orbital, each P subshell, level 2 and above, contains exactly three P orbitals, not just one. And what you can kind of see from this two-dimensional drawing, if you think of it in terms of perspective, is that the three identically shaped P orbitals within the subshell of the same level are mutually orthogonal, which really just is another phrase for being perpendicular. Each of one is perpendicular to the other two, like the x, y, and z axes of a three-dimensional graph. Right? Each axis is perpendicular to the other two. So this is perpendicular to this, and so on, and likewise for the other two. You can kind of see it better in the next slide, where they're labeled X, Y, and Z. And this is actually how you would distinguish them. So this is the same figure. Well, the bottom is exactly the same figure as the previous slide. But on the top part, even though they're really on top of each other, we're separating them to make sense of these definitions of the spaces. All right, so the overall picture, the bottom here, which is what we were just looking at in the previous slide, contains how many levels? Two are shown. Right, is everyone good with that? Levels one and two. How many subshells? You're saying one?
I'm counting.
Oh. You're saying two?
Three subshells.
There are three subshells. There's an S subshell in the first level. There's an S subshell in the second level. And there's a P subshell in the second level. All right. How many orbitals?
Oh, that's a lot more.
Five. Because you have the one S orbital, which makes up the entire first level S subshell. You have the 2S orbital, which makes up the entire subshell, S subshell of level 2. And then you have three different P orbitals that together make up the P subshell of level 2. That's five total orbitals. And we can distinguish, even though, since these are all in the second level, these P orbitals are called 2P orbitals. But there's three of them, and we can give them the names 2PX, 2PY, and 2PZ with subscripts to distinguish them. Okay. This is an important fact about orbitals. It doesn't matter what kind of orbital you're talking about, or what its shape is, what its letter designation is. Any individual orbital can contain at most 2 electrons. So there are 3 possibilities for any given individual orbital. It can be empty, meaning 0 electrons are there. It can contain 1, or it can contain 2. No other possibilities. All right? Now, let's look at the periodic table for a minute. The periodic table is a table, obviously, and you're used to tables having rows and columns, which it does, but we don't call them rows and columns when we're talking about the periodic table. The rows, even though they are rows, are called periods. And the columns are called groups. Notice that the periods on this left edge are numbered with integers, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Each period is numbered according to the outermost level. And by outermost level, I'm talking about a level that contains at least 1 electron. So we can keep counting levels, which are spaces, like in that second slide today. But if they're totally empty, we don't even really consider them. We only consider levels that have at least 1 electron in them. And that's what these period numbers are. All right. Now, I said a little bit ago that level 1 consists of only 1 subshell, the S subshell, which in turn contains only 1 orbital, the 1S orbital. So the entire shell contains only 1 orbital, right? And therefore, entire shell 1 can contain how many electrons maximum? 2, because any orbital can contain at most 2. Well, notice that there are exactly 2 elements listed in the first period. Hydrogen and helium. Now, what is it that makes any given element that particular element? Yeah, you don't have to raise your hand.
Oh, sorry.
No, you don't have to apologize either.
Anyway, so does that mean each orbital can only contain 2 electrons?
At most. It can contain 0, 1, or 2.
Yeah. Okay.
So now back to my question. What is it that makes any given element that particular element? Yeah.
Number of protons.
The number of protons that the atom contains. And that is the only thing, right?
Yeah.
So hydrogen is hydrogen only because it contains exactly one proton.
Yes.
But when we use the word atom, we are usually implying by that terminology that we're talking about a particle with no charge. An atom that has a total charge of zero. Well, the one proton that makes hydrogen hydrogen, of course, has a positive one charge. Protons are positively charged. And therefore, for the overall atom to be neutral, there has to be a negative one charge as well, which means there's
must be
an electron there as well. And for any given atom, which, like I said, implies neutral atom, however many protons there are, which is determined by what type of atom it is, there are also that many electrons for a total charge of zero. Okay? Helium is helium only because it contains two protons, but a neutral atom of it, therefore, contains two electrons as well. All right, well, lithium, the first atom listed in period two, is lithium because it has three protons. So it also has three electrons. Two of those electrons can be where they want to be, which is closest to the nucleus, in level one. But that's the limit, though, because level one contains one overall orbital.
Even the last one, either the second S2S or one of the three orbitals.
That's right. That third electron has to go somewhere, right? Has to be somewhere in one of those four orbitals that make up level two. And that's why it's listed. Lithium is listed in the second period. Because its outer level that contains at least one electron is the second one. So periods correspond to energy levels. Now, I need to talk about the word valence, which is used three different ways. So this can be confusing. You have to pay attention to the context, how the word is used. It's not always used alone. It can be used in a phrase, but differently. So one use of the word is to talk about a valence shell. A valence shell is just what we were talking about moment ago. A valence shell is the outermost shell in any given atom that is not completely empty, has at least one electron in it. And that's really what this period number tells you what it is. For lithium, it's level 2. That's the valence shell. It has a level 1, but those electrons are deeper in there. The outermost shell that contains an electron is shell 2 for lithium. Is that clear? Okay, now, another use of the word is to talk about valence electrons. Valence electrons are simply any electron occurring in that atom's valence shell, or outermost shell. Lithium has how many overall electrons?
Three.
How many valence electrons does it have?
One,
because the first two electrons occupy that lower level, which are not in the valence shell. The reason this is important, by the way, is because when two atoms encounter each other, which has to happen if there's any hope of a chemical reaction, there's going to be, if there is a reaction, a rearrangement of particles. But it's not rearrangement of just any particles. It's rearrangements of electrons, which should make sense. Because when two atoms meet, the nuclei don't hit each other, right?
The electrons.
They're deep in the core. The electrons are what come into contact, and not all of the electrons. The outermost ones are what come into contact. So the valence electrons are important because they're the ones that are involved in chemical reactions. All right? A third way of using the word valence is just by itself. We can talk about an atom's valence, which is different from an atom's number of valence electrons, which we just covered. An atom's valence is how many additional electrons it would take to fill up that atom's valence shell or subshell. All right? Now, let's look at hydrogen. What is its valence shell? Shell one. How many valence electrons?
One.
And what is its valence?
One.
Also one by coincidence, because for that first shell only, the maximum that the shell can hold is 2. And therefore the valence is 2, the maximum, minus how many you have, which is 1, equaling 1. But the valence you should always think of as how many additional electrons it would take to fill up that valence shell. Helium, notice, has an already filled valence shell. And that results in very high stability for that atom, or for any atom that's in that situation. A completely filled valence shell or subshell gives that atom particular stability. If you let me anthropomorphize or give human traits to the atoms, they want to be in that situation. All right? Which makes helium particularly happy. Helium doesn't want to have anything to do with other atoms. Doesn't want to undergo chemical reactions because it's nice and stable because of that full outer shell. It is. And it's not going, it doesn't even want to interact with other helium atoms. Now, groups are the columns, as I said. All the elements within one group have similar chemical characteristics, including all the ones that are in that rightmost group, which are collectively called the noble gases. The noble gases are inert. They don't, under ordinary circumstances, undergo any chemical reactions. They just exist on their own, nice and content because of their full valence shell. Everything else on the periodic table is at least partially unhappy, because they want to be like that right edge, and they're not. Okay? And that's why chemical reactions happen. Chemical reactions happen in such a way that the rearrangement of electrons allows the atoms involved in that reaction to attain the stability of the right edge elements, those noble gases. Yeah, go ahead. It has those orbitals in level 2, but level 2 is completely empty, so we don't even consider it. It's there. It's just like you could say there's another house right beside me. You don't see it because no one's in it, right? It's just if it's totally empty, we just ignore it. That's why the valence shell is defined as the outermost one that has at least one electron in it. So level 2, yes, it's there. It's just not being used. Now, another thing about the periodic table is that there are two major kinds of elements. They're all elements, obviously. That's what the periodic table is, an exhaustive listing of the elements. Roughly 100. But even though there's two major categories of elements, it's not a 50-50 split. There's very few non-metals, which are just this upper, except for the noble gases, this upper right-hand triangle. Those are the non-metals. Everything else below and to the left of that are the metals, with one exception, hydrogen. Hydrogen's over here on its own along with all the other metals, but it's a non-metal as well. Okay? So the majority of the elements are metals. Non-metals, notice, are close to that right edge, though, whereas metals are farther away, comparatively. Now, I mention this because we need to talk about the formation of ions as we start talking about chemical bonds. And I'll give a definition of that in a minute, but if we first look at slide 9, this is just an abbreviated periodic table. It's not the whole thing. It's just the first couple periods. And what's different about this compared to the one on the wall is that you have these little circular schematics. What does each circle here represent? Right, a shell, not an orbital. What do the dots represent?
Electrons.
Electrons, individually. And why do you know that these circles can't represent orbitals?
They're not
the orbital shape. Some of them are. Orbitals are circular. But why else?
Because they can't be in between shells, right?
That's true, too. But specifically, why can't these circles be orbitals?
Because orbitals can only have at utmost two.
Exactly. Look at this circle. It has six dots in it. Impossible for an orbital, right? So these circles are shells. They represent shells even though they don't represent the shape. Okay. And you can see that the right edge has a particular stability because that outer shell is full. That's what makes those noble gases nice and happy. Everything else, not quite content.
Those are Bohr models, right?
Yes. Now, if we think about metals compared to nonmetals, one distinction has to do with these valence electrons. Consider lithium that we've already talked about. Lithium has to have somewhere to put its third electron, which is why it has to have the second shell as its valence shell. Well, the valence shell has how many subshells? The second shell, which is the valence shell for lithium. Two subshells, S and P. How many orbitals?
Four.
A single 2S and three different 2Ps, right? For a total of four orbitals in the second shell. Is that clear? And therefore, the second shell has a maximum number of what for its electrons? What's the maximum number of electrons that the second shell can hold?
Eight.
Two in each of its four orbitals. And that's why eight is a special number in chemistry. That's what's behind the octet rule. It's not 8 for the first, because the first shell has only one orbital in it, so the maximum is 2. Second shell has 4 orbitals, though, so the maximum number is 8. And lithium is using that second shell, but for only one electron, right? Plenty of room for that one electron. It can hold 7 more. So in terms of valence, you would say lithium's valence is 7 because it would take 7 more to fill it. That would make it just as happy as neon on the right edge, which has a completely filled second shell. All right? The metals are on the left part of the periodic table. And so in general, metals have a valence shell that is more empty than full, because they're closer to this left edge, right? They're just starting to fill that outer shell. Nonmetals, on the other hand, that triangle, have valence shells that are more full than empty. So let's compare the two situations. A metal will be happy if it has a full outer shell. Lithium could be made happy by adding 7 electrons. But that's a hell of a lot more difficult than it is to simply get rid of that one electron in its current valence shell Because if you do that, this second shell is empty and it's no longer the valent shell there. Therefore, right? That means its new valent shell is shell 1, which is already filled. It makes it as happy as helium. It would be an ion either way, by either adding or subtracting electrons, and we'll go on there in a second. But that's true of metals in general. It's easier for them to lose electrons because their outer shell is more empty than full than it is to gain an even greater number of electrons than they're losing. Yeah. What makes it full is that all of the orbitals in that shell have two in them. The first shell has only one orbital total, and therefore the entire shell is filled when there are two electrons there to fill that one orbital that it has, the S orbital. And that's why helium's happy. Okay. Well, if lithium loses that one, then its outer shell is suddenly this first level instead of the second, which is now empty. And so that makes it just as happy as helium.
If you had like a third shell, would you try to like keep losing it until you get back to the first one?
No, you would lose them only until you get to the point where your remaining valent shell is already filled. So, but for instance, I'm glad you said that, because beryllium is unhappy as well. But it's going to need to lose two in order to get just like helium. Okay? So metals... Well, before I go on to that statement, let me just say that we're starting to talk now about ions. When we use the word atom, it means the overall thing is uncharged, has a charge of zero because it has the same number of electrons as protons. And they add up, the negatives and the positives add up to zero. But the word ion refers to a particle that's charged. And it can be a collection of atoms, but it can also just be a single atom. So let's talk about monatomic ions, ions that are made of one atom. Now, if the only requirement, which is true, for being an ion is that you have a charge different from zero, then there could be four ways that could happen. There isn't, but there could be just logically. Well, something has to be true for there to be a non-zero charge, which is the number of electrons has to not equal the number of protons. As long as the two don't have this, as long as the two don't equal each other, the number of protons and the number of electrons, then there is going to be some charge other than zero. In other words, a true charge. Right? That can happen in either of two directions, meaning that the charges can add up to a negative number or they can add up to a positive number, depending on which type of particle there's more of, electrons or protons. So, ion is the big set of particles that are charged, the overall set, but there's two non-overlapping, mutually exclusive subsets of ions. Positively charged ions, which are called cations, and negatively charged ions, which are called anions. Now, back to this four ways that you could make an ion. You would produce a charged particle if you either added protons or took protons away while leaving the number of electrons the same. Right? Because the number of protons and electrons would no longer equal each other if you either added protons or took protons away. So that's two ways. Or you could add electrons and keep the number of protons the same, or take away electrons. That's two more ways. You all agree that any one of those would result in an ion, right? Because the positives and the negatives would no longer add up to zero. But only two of those happen. When an atom becomes an ion, the number of protons does not change. If you were to change the number of protons, you would be changing the element, right? Because of the definition of an element. You would no longer have the same element. So, atoms form ions not by changing the number of protons, but by changing the number of electrons. So there really are two ways this can happen. An atom can either lose or gain electrons, either of which will cause some non-zero charge. But what is the charge if electrons are gained?
Negative.
It's going to be -1, -2, depending on how many more electrons there are than protons, right? The gaining of negative charges is going to make the overall atom negatively charged, and therefore an anion. Taking away electrons, but keeping the protons the same, keeping them there, is going to result in a cation, a positively charged ion. Well, because metals are more empty than full, and because they therefore find it easier to lose a small number of electrons rather than gain a bigger number of electrons, metals in general form ions by losing electrons, and therefore they form specifically cations. Metals become positively charged ions because they lose some of those electrons, and now you have more positives than negatives.
In an instance where, such as carbon, there's an equal number of electrons.
Yeah.
So if you need to gain 4 electrons or lose 4 electrons, would it still be easier to lose electrons or gain electrons?
Gain. And that's what happens for carbon, which is a nonmetal. It's in that upper right-hand corner. Carbon is the most important nonmetal, which we'll talk about. That's why it has its own chapter. But that's good thinking. All right? Nonmetals, on the other hand, being close to that right edge, are more full than empty, and therefore nonmetals form ions by gaining a fewer number of electrons rather than losing a greater number of electrons. And they therefore become negatively charged anions. Another thing about the periodic table, when we talk about valence, which is particularly important for nonmetals, by the way, but you can define it for the others, you can practically think of an atom's valence as how many steps or how many groups, columns, away from the right edge it is. Fluorine, notice, element 9, is the most reactive element because it's almost there. It's almost as happy as neon, but it's one step away. Right? It's element 9, which means it has 9 protons and therefore 9 electrons. But those two of those electrons are already filling up level 1. Level 2, which is its valence shell, can hold 8, but it has 7 beyond the 2 that are in the lower level, and so it's almost full, not quite. It has 7, it can hold one more, and how many more it can hold is the valence. So the valence is some number which depends on the level minus how many it has. But practically, you can look at it as how many steps away from the right edge it is. Fluorine is one step away from neon. So its valence is 1. Oxygen's valence is 2. 2 steps away. Also, well, I'll get to that when we talk more about bonds, which we're getting to now. Slide 10. We'll talk about several different kinds of bonds in this course, and a bond is something, it's a force of attraction. A bond holds things together, to a certain degree at least. But only certain bonds are classified as chemical bonds. Eventually we'll talk about hydrogen bonds, which is an example of a bond that's not a chemical bond. What distinguishes a chemical bond from any other kind of bond is that if that chemical bond forms you no longer have the stuff you started with. You have new substance with its own characteristics, different from the characteristics of the reactants. So in chemical reactions in general, what happens is that certain bonds are broken, certain bonds are formed, and you create new stuff, like the examples we've already looked at. That's why they're called chemical bonds, because if they form, you have new chemicals. Okay? So chemical bonds is one big category of bonds. Now we can break that into subcategories. There are more than what I'm going to talk about, but for this course, we only concern ourselves with two major kinds of chemical bonds, which are ionic bonds and covalent bonds. Now, the word ionic implies that ions are involved, and that's true. We're looking in slide 10 at an example of an ionic bond forming. Ionic bonds not only feature ions, as the name indicates, but they are the weakest of the chemical bonds. There are weaker bonds, but they are not chemical bonds. Ionic bonds are weak chemical bonds, but still chemical bonds, and therefore if they form, you're creating new stuff. Further, an ionic bond occurs between some metal and some non-metal. And this example will hopefully make it clear why that makes sense. That's not true, by the way, of covalent bonds. We'll talk about those next. But here you have a metal and a non-metal, sodium and chlorine. Sodium's here at 11, chlorine's over there at 17. Look at the shells here. The valence shell for sodium is 3. It only has 1 in it, though, right? So it's kind of like lithium above it, which, like I said, things in the same group have similar properties. So you could take on an additional 7 here, but it's much easier to lose that 1, eliminate that outer shell, or ignore it, and therefore the valence shell is now shell 2, which is already filled. So that is what sodium wants to happen. Chlorine is in the converse situation. Its valence shell is almost full. It just needs one more, one step away from the right edge. And so chlorine will gladly take an electron from sodium, which will gladly give it up. And that's why it happens. Energetically, it happens because that makes each atom more stable than it was before. And notice that the metal is losing the electron, the non-metal is accepting the electron. There's only one particle that's being transferred, and that's a hallmark of ionic bonds. There is a transfer of some number of electrons from one participant to the other. But it's specifically from the metal to the non-metal. But even though it's only one electron we're talking about, one particle, one transfer, that simultaneously produces two ions. Because each one now no longer has an equal number of electrons as protons, right? So it makes the sodium ion the sodium atom a sodium ion, which is a cation because it's now positively charged. It has one more proton than electrons. At the same time, it makes the chlorine atom a chloride ion. The nonmetals change their name. Chloride is an ion, and it's an anion because it now has one more electron than it has protons. So I haven't said anything about a bond yet other than saying that this slide has to do with ionic bonds. What is the bond? Well, the bond results simply from the electrostatic attraction of ions that are oppositely charged. Oppositely charged particles attract each other. And this is why it makes sense that it's going to be a metal and a non-metal reacting in an ionic bond. Nonmetals make negative ions. If that happens to two nonmetals, you're going to have two negative ions. Those would repel each other, not attract each other, and similarly with two metals. So an ionic bond forms between a metal and a nonmetal because that's going to form a positively charged metallic ion and a negatively charged nonmetallic ion, which are then going to attract each other because of that difference in their electrostatic charge direction. Make sense? All right, well, we're looking at this happening. This is, by the way, the same exact reaction that we started with on the first day. Sodium and chlorine, both of which can kill you, reacting to form sodium chloride, something that you need. Right. Now, sodium chloride is called salt usually. It is one of many examples of a salt. It's specifically sodium chloride, but there's all kinds of salts. Salts, as a word, just refers to ionic compounds. And recall that compound in general, more generally than ionic compounds, compounds are substances made up of at least two different kinds of elements. In this case, exactly two elements, sodium and chlorine. Okay? But sodium chloride, the salt, the ionic compound, has properties that drastically differ from sodium's properties or chlorine's properties. That's why it's new stuff. And that's why the bond is a chemical bond. You're creating a new chemical. This is shown happening to exactly one chlorine atom and exactly one sodium atom. But in reality, that almost never occurs. There's trillions and trillions of each, not just one of each. So if we look in slide 11, we see many yellow sodium ions and many green chloride ions. The transfer has happened from one to the other for all of these. All right, so that each one is an ion, but the green ones are negatively charged, the yellow ones are positively charged. If you think about an individual ion, a sodium ion, positively charged, it is not positive in just one of directions away from itself. It is positive in all of the directions around it. So it will be attracted to any negative particle around it and in all directions. And similarly for the other kind of ion. A negative chloride ion is negative in all directions. So as long as you keep adding ions of both types, they will form a crystal in which each individual ion is simultaneously attracted to many different copies of the same oppositely charged ion around it. And what I mean, why this is important, is that salts don't have a defined size. They can be as big as you have ions to make them. And when they mine salt, for instance, for sale as table salt, they're digging from chunks that are bigger than buildings. It's all one chunk. So there is no limit to how big a salt particle can be, crystal, but there is a lower limit. And if I were to ask the general public, just randomly, what they think the smallest piece of salt is, a lot of them would say just one molecule of salt. But that's wrong, because the word molecule is not used for ionic compounds. A molecule has a defined size. It's not arbitrarily big, like a salt is. Instead, the smallest piece of a salt that you can have and still have that salt is called a formula unit. For the specific salt called sodium chloride, a formula unit would be exactly one sodium ion and exactly one chloride ion. You can't have fewer than that, right? Because then you won't have the compound at all. But if you have at least one of each, then you have salt, and that's the smallest piece. There is no predefined size, though. It can be as big as you want. Well, that's not true for compounds that are made from other kinds of bonds that we're getting to, which are covalent bonds. And only for covalently bonded collections of atoms do we use the word molecule. And I'll just save more to say about that for when we look at molecules, which starts now in slide 12. This is the second major category of chemical bonds, which is covalent bonds. And the name, what does co as a prefix mean? It means share, like co-stars share a lead in a movie, for instance. So the word covalent etymologically tells you that that kind of bond involves a sharing of valence electrons. Not a transfer, like in ionic bonds. Okay? We use the example of two hydrogen atoms becoming a molecule of hydrogen, which is a covalent structure. Well, this is just a specific example, but for in general, for covalent bonds, unlike ionic bonds, you have a nonmetal and a nonmetal getting together. Now, as this example illustrates, you don't have to have two different nonmetals. They just both have to be nonmetals. In this case, they're both hydrogen, but hydrogen is a nonmetal, remember, even though it's over there on the left with the metals. So molecules, which are made of covalent bonds, involve just this relatively small subset of elements called the nonmetals. But even though there aren't all that many nonmetals, there's an effectively infinite number of ways you can combine them, which is why we've already made millions of different covalent compounds, and there's no limit to more that we could make. All right, now, more about this, the essence of covalent bonding, which is that instead of there being a transfer of an electron or more from one to the other participant, there is instead a sharing. Let's think about each hydrogen atom in isolation. They're identical to each other, but each hydrogen has a valence of what? One, because it requires one more electron for that hydrogen to be happy, like helium, to have its valence shell filled. And that's because that valence shell, in the case of hydrogen, can hold at most two, and it already has one. So it can hold one more. The same exact situation exists for the other. Now, each individual hydrogen greedily would gladly take an electron from the other, right? But they're equally greedy. They equally want one more electron. And so neither of them is going to go for that deal of transferring one to the other. Instead, if they strike a deal and agree that each of the hydrogens will share its own electron with the other, then both hydrogens will get credit for both electrons. There's two total electrons in these two atoms. But if that pair of electrons, one from each of the participants, is shared by both nuclei, then each nucleus gets credit for having two electrons, and it makes it just like helium. Nice and stable. All right? That's what covalent bonding is. Importantly, a covalent bond never involves a sharing of a single electron. It's always pairs of electrons that are shared, either one pair, two pairs, or three pairs. because for it to be sharing, both of them have to contribute an electron to the sharing, right? So it's at least two, and it's exactly two in the case of hydrogens getting together. You can see this as a merging of their electron clouds around their nuclei on the bottom. This is no longer two hydrogen atoms. This is now a hydrogen molecule, which is still an element, hydrogen, but it's in molecular form rather than atomic form. And that has different properties compared to hydrogen atoms. So it's new stuff, even though it's not a compound. Covalent bonds don't have to form compounds, but they can form compounds if the nonmetals involved are different kinds of nonmetals, right? Because then you're going to fulfill the definition of being a compound, which is involving more than one element. Water is a good example of that. One oxygen and two hydrogens coming together, and notice oxygen is also a nonmetal. That's going to form one molecule of water. Exactly. I was just about to say that, so thanks. I said earlier that the ionic bonds are the weakest of the chemical bonds. Well, covalent bonds are not only stronger, they are much stronger. That sharing of the pair of electrons keeps these two atomic nuclei together much better than the electrostatic force of attraction between an anion and a cation in an ionic compound. Now the sharing, we don't really know where the electrons are exactly at any given moment. We just know probabilistically where they might be. So even though it's not the truth, you can think of a pair of covalently shared electrons, one from each of the two atoms, as kind of orbiting in a figure eight. That's not really what happens. But they are spending some time around each of the two atoms. That's why they're being shared. Not necessarily, but they could be, yes.
Yeah.
But the point is, they're not just with one atom permanently or the other, like in an ionic compound. All right? And valence, as it applies to nonmetals, same definition for valence that I already gave you. But another way of practically thinking about valence is that if that nonmetal atom is going to be part of a molecule, meaning it's going to be forming covalent bonds with others, whatever its valence is before the reaction occurs, before the bonding occurs, that valence tells you how many covalent bonds it has to make in order to be satisfied. What we're looking at here is the formation of what's called a single covalent bond. But importantly, a single covalent bond is two electrons, right? A single covalent bond is a pair of electrons shared by the two. And that's it's a strong bond, much stronger than an ionic bond, but it's the weakest of the three subcategories of covalent bonds. Let's go to 13 and look at a single bond compared to a double bond. On the left, we have what we just looked at, only it's expressed differently with just symbols. These symbols, by the way, are called electron dot diagrams. An electron dot diagram uses the element's symbol, in this case H for hydrogen, to represent the nucleus.
And then we use dots for the shell and the electrons.
Right. We use dots for electrons, but not just any electrons. Only the valence electrons, because those are the ones that are involved in transferring or sharing. So in this case, there is only one total electron for hydrogen, and that's why each one has a dot. That shell, though, which is the area around this nucleus, can hold two. That's why each one wants to get credit for another one. And if they both share their one with the other, they both get credit for these two that are shared. That's a single covalent bond, one pair of shared electrons. Oxygen's valence is 2. Its atomic number is 8. It has 8 electrons. 2 are in the lower shell, though, so they're not valence electrons. 6 valence electrons in the second shell, which can hold 8, means that the valence of oxygen is 8 minus 6, or 2. But notice it's two steps away from the right edge. Its valence is 2. Therefore, oxygen in any molecule it's going to be part of, each oxygen atom needs to be forming 2 covalent bonds. Well, you can do that by forming 2 separate covalent bonds, like happens in water. But you can also share with the same co-participant 2 pairs of electrons to form what's called a double bond. And that will satisfy each of the 2 oxygens. A double bond is even stronger than a single covalent bond. But it satisfies the valence, right? Because each of those 2 oxygens gets credit for an additional 4. I mean, for an additional 2. 4 overall shared, but each one gets credit for an additional 2, which brings them to 8. And there's even such a thing as a triple covalent bond.
Is there a triple?
And actually, this has important biological consequences. Nitrogen, notice, has a valence of 3. 3 steps away from the right edge, right?
Yeah.
5 valence electrons. It needs 3 more, so its valence is 3. It needs to be forming 3 bonds in any molecule it's part of. Well, you can get 2 nitrogens together to form a nitrogen molecule. And they will be sharing 3 pairs of electrons between them for a total of 6 overall electrons. I could do this as 6 dots. Each pair of dots can also be 1 line. You can denote it a bond either way. Triple bond is the hardest to break. And as a matter of fact, no. Triple bonds are so hard to break that only a very small number of bacteria are able to break them. And we wouldn't exist without them. Nothing else would exist without them, really. Because every organism needs nitrogen. And those of us that live surrounded by air, which we do, there's plenty of nitrogen there. The air is 3/4 nitrogen. So no shortage. But it's nitrogen N2 with a triple bond, and none of us has the ability to break those bonds. So we can't get the nitrogen that we vitally need just from the air. We have to have the few species of bacteria that are able to break that bond turn this molecular nitrogen into nitrogen compounds, nitrogen-containing compounds that we then use and get our nitrogen from.
That's why we have nitrogen-fixing soil.
That's right. Nitrogen-fixing bacteria are able to break those triple bonds.
Oh, nice.
Tis nice. All right, let's go to slide 14 and just look at different ways you can denote these covalent structures. I say covalent structures because they don't have to be compounds, right? Like oxygen gas and hydrogen gas are molecules. Covalent structures are molecules, but they're not necessarily compounds. A molecule is a compound only if there are 2 or more different kinds of atoms in it. Well, you see that with water. But for any example of a molecule, each individual nonmetal, one of the atoms in it, is going to be making a total of covalent bonds, a total number of covalent bonds that equals its valence. The valence of an atom tells you how many bonds it's going to be participating in. Oxygen has a valence of 2. Well, it's forming 1 single covalent bond with a hydrogen and another single covalent bond with another hydrogen for a total of 2 bonds. In an oxygen molecule, O2, it's forming 1 double bond, but that counts as 2 bonds. So it's still satisfying its valence. Hydrogen has a valence of 1, so every hydrogen involved in a molecule is forming 1 bond with something, not more. Okay. 15 brings us to water molecule again, but now to talk about something special about water. With what I've told you in mind, we already know that if you are considering a bond, a chemical bond, then you know there are two possibilities, right? Ionic or covalent. And you can distinguish the two by whether there is a transfer of electrons to form ions or whether there is a sharing of pairs of electrons for a covalent bond, right? So covalent is already a subdivision of chemical bonds. But there's a subdivision of covalent bonds. You can subdivide covalent bonds based on how that sharing occurs. And so the two categories, subdivisions of covalent bonds are nonpolar and polar covalent bonds. Now the word polar is used a lot in science. And it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with charge. Polar by itself simply means that something about that thing you're calling polar has two different ends, different from each other in some respect. Like north and south pole, for instance, yes, of a magnet or of the earth. But in this case, charge does matter. It's the distinction. All right, now, first of all, for a bond to be covalent, there has to be sharing. Otherwise, it wouldn't be covalent. But, as you might already have experienced in life, you can have such a situation as sharing that isn't necessarily equal sharing. Right? Someone might hog whatever is being shared in the deal. It is possible to have equal sharing, though, as well. So that's the basis for there being two different categories of covalent bonds, polar and nonpolar. If there is equal sharing, and remember we're talking about a pair of electrons, not a single electron, but a pair. But if that pair of electrons is equally shared, that means both of the participating atoms, the ones doing the sharing, have that shared pair around them just as much as the other one has that pair around them. In other words, the pair of shared electrons is spending equal amounts of time around each of the two atomic nuclei. That's equal sharing. Now, the reason this matters is because electrons are negatively charged, right? If you have the other possibility, which is still sharing, but unequal sharing, then that means one of the two atomic nuclei is going to have that pair of shared electrons around it more often than the other one does. And therefore, that one, you can think of the bond as having two ends. Each end is one of the two atomic nuclei. Whichever atom has that pair of electrons around it more often, that end of the bond is going to be, therefore, slightly negative because the electrons are carrying negative charge. Now, notice I said slightly negative. It doesn't make it an ion because it's not a permanent transfer. Those electrons are not always there. If they were always there, then they would give that one atom a negative 2 charge because it's a pair of electrons, right? Negative 2. It's not that, though. It's a partial charge, not an integer value, a fractional value of negative charge, which we denote with a lowercase Greek delta. Right, the capital delta is an equilateral triangle, where the lowercase is like that, small d. Delta negative means slightly negative, not quite zero. Delta positive, slightly positive. And the delta positive will be always on the end of the bond where the shared pair of electrons is spending less time. Delta positive, where it's less time, right? Because those negatives are not there as often. And the protons that they're already shines through more, yes. The delta negative is always on the end of the bond where the electrons that are being shared are spending more time, and therefore they're contributing to that negative charge. So that's why it's a polar bond, because the polarity of it is that the two ends are different in some respect, in this case with respect to partial charge.
But So that H2O molecule, it's like two positive ends, one negative end, and it's in like a triangle.
That's right. That's right. Except that it's electrostatic charge, not magnetic force. But it's analogous, yes. Okay, now I'm just about out of time, so I will just say that this makes a hell of a lot of difference. None of us, no organism would exist if it weren't for this property of water, which is why water has its own chapter in the course. But I'll continue next time. See you in the lab.